From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear a conversation with young Latina women who are working towards an inclusive future and fighting for the rights of undocumented people.
I've told this to many people who are undocumented and are DACA recipients who have said, like, well, like, I don't want to put myself up there and say I'm undocumented because then now I'm a target. And I've told them, it's like, you're a target either way.
Then we'll look at how we judge judges and our expectations of judicial candidates. Plus, we'll help you plan a trip to the Wisconsin Dells.
You know, it's not necessarily one thing. It's all of the things. This is a little town with big ambitions, and there's a lot of local families here that run some major businesses in town.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you for joining us. Each month, we bring together Milwaukeeans for a segment we call Group Chat, where we hand over the microphone to people making a difference in the community and let them lead the conversation. There's been a flurry of news lately about immigration and people without legal status, but that hasn't stopped advocates and organizers from doing their work. This month, we'll hear from two organizers from the young adult movement called Comité Sin Fronteras, or Committee Without Borders, who are committed to advocating for immigration reform. Here's Fernanda Jimenez and Daisy Espana.
Well, my name is Fernanda, and I'm a DACA recipient. But I do like to mention that I'm undocumented, protected under DACA temporarily, because we know that DACA has only been a temporary fix in the immigration system. And is in limbo. On the side, on my own time, I am the founder of Comité Sin Fronteras and one of the leading organizers now with my comrades, and I like to call friends because they're more than comrades now.
My name is Daisy Espana. I am 22. I am a member of Comité Sin Fronteras and Voces de la Frontera. I'm an organizer. I've been able to establish pretty good relationships with organizations in Milwaukee and across the state. Last fall, I ran for assembly. I didn't win, but that's okay. I'll do it again. I think I'm one of only, is it two or three U.S. citizens in the committee? I think you're just one of two.
Yeah. So we do joke. We joke about how Daisy is for the people. And as much as it's a joke or we carry it as a joke, we know it's not a joke. If ICE is in 13th and Lapham and Daisy hears about it, Daisy is there. She'll say, bet, I'm going. And she does. So my question to you is, why is it and how and where does the bravery come from for you to be so committed and devoted to the work that you do?
Just to backtrack, for the people. So that was my slogan when I ran for assembly. I mean, it's still for the people. Right? I got shirts and everything, right? So, I mean, I can point at different stories or situations throughout, like, my upbringing. My parents are from Mexico, and my dad's still undocumented. My mom became a permanent resident a little over a year and a half ago. But growing up, I constantly heard, like, my parents talk about, don't open the door to anybody, even if they're your tia or your sister. Like, don't open the door, right? And I'm like, damn, like, I gotta keep my sister outside. But in reality, it was because of fear, right? Like, specifically, there's this one time when we were kids. We were coming back from Chicago, and a sheriff stopped my dad. All of a sudden, I see my mom, like, starts praying, and she says, like, out loud that she hopes that they give him, like, the most expensive ticket ever, but not that she sees, like, a nice car or vehicle. And to me, I was like, what the heck? Just something is not right. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, growing up on the South Side, the differences between the South Side and the East Side, or there was this one time, there was, like, a block party, and I was hanging out with the cops. And I was like, what's up, you know? And my mom got so mad. She's like, why are you doing that? Like, they're not, you know, they're not there to, like, protect you. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, that's their job. And so when you ask about, like, where does that bravery come from? I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a bit nerve-wracking, too. You know, like, I'll say, like, I'm there, right? And I'm, like, nervous. But I still go because it's, like, someone taught me that the most impactful piece of protest that you have is, like, your body. And to me, it's, like, nothing that I'll ever do will compare to the struggle and fear and experiences that the immigrant community faces. So the least I could do is, like, stand in front of an ICE agent to protect my friends and family and community. I tell people all the time when they're afraid to, like, organize.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who's going to do it if you don't?
There's nothing has been given to you.
Yeah.
We think about all of the different policies that are pro-immigrant, and people are grateful for them, and they really think, like, oh, the government gave it to us, or Obama gave this to us. And it's never the case that just because they were in office, they gave it to you. It was always fought by people so that that policy would have been implemented. I mean, we've talked about DACA being that way. Many DACA recipients think that Obama passed that executive order because he wanted to. I'm not saying he didn't, but it took a lot of work for him to agree on passing that as an executive order. And it was all by the people. There was people like around our age who fought for the DREAM Act, didn't go through, and then DACA was able to happen. And now, I mean, like myself, I have DACA and I'm able to work legally and have some protection, some, in this country, but it's all by us. And that's honestly how I think immigration reform is going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be by the people, and it's only going to be a push for them to actually say, you know what? Yeah, sure. What the heck? Yeah.
What the heck? No, yeah. But speaking about for the people, with the people, and by the people, and I don't think I've asked you this ever, for that matter, but you mentioned, I mean, you're a DACA recipient. You are protected to an extent, but you essentially are undocumented, and you're still, like, you founded Comité. You say yes to, like, putting your picture out there. You, like, you really don't care. Like I don't care. But, homegirl, like, you're, like, undocumented, and I guess my question is if you can talk about how you feel as somebody who's undocumented. But on top of that, how you feel as somebody who's undocumented, who is at the forefront of this movement, trying to get other undocumented folks to be involved when there's just a lot of, like, fear.
I'll start off by saying I'm a natural anxious person, and I've been diagnosed with anxiety, where my therapist has said, you were just born anxious, and you that's just who you are. So, like, to me, I've always been anxious and afraid. Like, you can't say that I am 100% unafraid. I am. I'm afraid for myself, obviously, happening the worst case scenario. I'm afraid for my parents, who are a lot more vulnerable than me. I'm afraid for the people who are a lot more vulnerable than my parents. And even if I don't know them, they're my community. And I do fear for the worst case scenario. But I also think that living in fear just makes your life completely worse. And it doesn't do anything to progress for what we're trying to solve. And I think only being in community keeps you so safe. If you don't have a community, you're in a much more difficult situation.
Yeah.
I've told this to many people who are undocumented and are DACA recipients who have said, like, well, like, I don't want to put myself up there and say I'm undocumented because then now I'm a target. And I've told them, it's like, you're a target either way. Even not saying it up front and to, you know, on the news or whatever, or just, like, to people in public, you're a target. If you're a DACA recipient, your information has been given to the government already. So you're already seen as undocumented. And if DACA is taken away, you're undocumented now. If you have been in other places that you said you're undocumented, you're already out there. Your status is out there. And when you don't have community and something were to happen to you, that's when it makes it difficult to protect you. And if you had community, then you're much harder to target. And without community, someone who is not out there, they would have been easily detained and easily deported. And I think that's really what's kept me just going. Like I said, I'm afraid. I'm always afraid. Mm-hmm. I'm like a little chihuahua. if I was a pet, I'd be a chihuahua. Because that's how much I shake. Oh. I shake now. But I really think that the community and the people around me keep me going and make me feel that being afraid isn't going to get us anywhere, or me, anywhere. And now I feel like I'm not alone. We're talking about all this, you know, fear and, like, how we've been trying to get away from fear. We've been trying to be more hopeful and to organize our communities more so that we can really get to what the final solution is and our goal, which is a pathway to citizenship, but also what happens after a pathway to citizenship. Like, what's the fight? The fight's going to be continuous. The solution is not just immigration reform. There's so much to immigration and to immigrants because everything is intersectional. So I'm wondering, how do you envision the world in the immigrant rights movement in the future and beyond what we are seeing now?
Yeah. Has anyone seen the Hunger Games? No, but I think how I like to see it is from the bottom up, mm-hmm. where it's like, how do we first win, like, at the county mm-hmm. level, and then at the city level, and then mm-hmm. the state level, right? Like, sure, you know, how many years have we been, like, pushing for a pathway to citizenship? Mm-hmm. Even when we had the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. the Senate, and the White House controlled mm-hmm. by the Democrats, and nothing was passed.
Mm-hmm. We're right? so close. One vote away.
Super close. Obviously, we'll keep organizing. Obviously, we'll keep marching and protesting and calling our Congress people and, you know, you name it. That won't stop. But I think, like, my thing has always been, like, local government. So my job now is to recruit mm-hmm. people to run for office. The time frame, I'm not sure, because, like you said, you know, we think about the next 4 years, and it's kind of like, oof, where is the political and economic state of the world going to be? You know what I mean? Are we going to lose people? Mm. We can have this plan, but we won't know until mm-hmm. we're there, mm-hmm. right? And so right now, I think we're having an influx of people who are, like, calling us or wanting to be involved. I mean, like, our posts are getting an insane amount of shares. So it's doing good right now, but we've seen it with, like, the May Day marches, right? Mm-hmm. Since 2007, we've been fighting to reinstate driver's license. Mm-hmm. And every single year, we march. Mm-hmm. And every single year, you see a decrease of people. And it's not because people don't want to march or don't want to fight. It's like people are tired. Mm-hmm. And so how many years can go by before you start losing people?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But I think, like, what you were saying about people are tired, mm-hmm. I agree. People are tired. And that's why I believe that our generation that needs investment in what leadership looks like, and you said it perfectly. I mean, locally, we need to get those people in office, mm-hmm. And that'll take time. But education is so crucial now, and I think we have the people in the room. Yeah. It's just bringing out that education to them and really implementing it all over. And even, I think, like, internationally, like, we see that it's not just a national issue.
Yeah.
It's an international issue of immigration being such a stigma. They're not treated fairly. They're not treated like humans. Yeah, I fully agree with you. I think there's going to be a lot of work. People are tired, and we need to give them a moment to be tired too.
Yeah.
We can't just make them fight all the time, because I get tired.
Right.
I'm tired right now.
I'm gonna take a nap.
Matter of fact. But yeah, I think it's okay to be tired.
Yeah.
And there's always gonna be someone who is gonna be working for you and with you.
Yeah.
And that's really what matters.
Yeah, it's like, take your time.
Yeah.
We'll hold it down for right now.
We got it.
But then you know, like,
yes.
You come in and let me take a break.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Tag team.
Tag team. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's how we win.
That's right.
That was Fernanda Jimenez, founder of Comité Sin Fronteras, and Daisy España, an organizer with Comité Sin Fronteras and Voces de la Frontera. This group chat was produced by WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. Season 2 of Swing State of the Union is here. This time, podcast hosts and producers Joy Powers and Sam Woods are going to court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The first episode, Welcome to Court, explains the responsibilities of courts in the state, why we elect judges, and what makes a good judge. That's where Chad Oldfather comes in. Oldfather is a professor of law at Marquette University and the author of Judges, Judging, and Judgment. Oldfather's conversation with Joy and Sam is featured in Episode 1 and looks at how we assess jurists and our expectations of judicial candidates. He begins by explaining what he thinks makes a good judge.
I think that what's at the core of it, the book's called Judges, Judging, and Judgment, and it's good judgment, ultimately, that I think is at the core of it. I think it's the case that everyone in their personal lives knows people who they regard as having good judgment and knows people whose judgment they wouldn't trust at all. And those things are loosely, if at all, correlated with things like raw intelligence or, you know, possession of certain expert or abstract knowledge, political views, and so forth, right? And so the idea is that I think, even though we can't do it precisely, we can identify at least certain components of what makes someone have good judgment. Being dispassionate, I think, is a big part of that. So too is intellectual humility, right? The idea that I might be wrong and I should always be asking myself, what if I'm wrong about this? I was quite struck. I saw the movie Conclave recently, and there's that speech that's kind of a key moment in the film where the cardinal who's leading the conclave opens it by saying, you know, I've come to believe that the greatest sin is certainty. And that really resonates with the idea that I'm pitching in this book, that we all ought to be a little less sure of ourselves, and we live in a world in which there's a lot of people who are very sure of themselves, and that frightens me.
There's a word that you used in that I find interesting, this idea of being dispassionate. Because I think, especially as we look at elected leaders, the people who we tend to be attracted to are these often firebrand kind of personalities. And yet, to be dispassionate is quite the opposite. Why do you think this is key to being a good judge?
I think it's just what the judicial role calls for, right? That if I'm a judge, particularly a judge whose job involves, to some greater or lesser degree, making law that is supposed to apply going forward, I have to be able to take myself outside the specific facts that are presented and look down the road and ask, how's this case going to matter in the next case and the one after that in situations where the shoe's on the other foot and it might be my side, if I have a side that is asking for what, in this case, the other side's asking for. And think about, well, what, you know, what's the right answer? What's the fair answer? What's the best answer? You know, you're never going to fully escape the influence of things like politics and ideology. I think law, you know, sort of floats in a sea of politics and norms and customs and all these sorts of things. So you can't get away from it entirely. But I think that doesn't mean you have to give into it completely. And, you know, it's really recognizing that under the rule of law, one of the core ideas is my team's not always going to win. That's how law is supposed to work. You know, it doesn't seem like that big of an ask. But on the other hand, you look around sometimes and you think, apparently it is a pretty big ask.
When you look at these qualities that make for a good judge, how does that square with the qualities that we think of making a good candidate? Are those two in opposition to one another, or do they – how do you look at that?
Sure, yeah. Sure. There's certainly a tension, I think, there in the sense that if one is looking to appeal to the electorate generally, you're absolutely correct in suggesting that people seem to be drawn to those who can confidently state their beliefs. You know, so I think changing the culture's view on this is an awfully big ask. Changing the profession's view, the legal profession's view, I think is less of an ask. And I think that's the place to start, that we within the legal profession really need to not allow ourselves to be polarized in the same ways and to the same extent that the world is polarized, and to try to converge around like certain norms, certain things that this is how judges should be. And if we as a profession and we in legal education can cultivate those values, then we'll produce lawyers who will become judicial candidates who will manifest those values. We will praise judges who exhibit those values, even if we don't agree with how they've applied them in a given case. And we'll criticize judges who don't. I don't think that's too much to ask. I think it's still a heavy-ish lift, but I'd like to think it's a doable one.
So in the description of your book, you mention constraints and pressures on judges today. Can you talk about what you mean by constraints and pressures seen on judges?
Sure. Lots of it gets into the weeds of how the legal system operates. There are things like, for the most part, when judges make decisions and issue them out into the world, we expect that they'll be justified in writing, right? Which is different from how legislators make decisions, right? Nobody expects that any given member of a legislature is going to have to explain why they voted as they did. It's enough that they were elected into office to do this job and make these votes. Not so with judges, right? We expect them to tell a story about why this decision is a product of and is connected to the law. What's happened over the last, you know, say 75 years or so at this point is that judges have increasingly delegated that work to others, usually to law clerks who are pretty recently out of law school, right? So you have these novices offering up the justifications for decisions. And not surprisingly, as a brand new lawyer, I think it's fair to say that if a very senior judge tells me, here's how I'm thinking of deciding this case, could you write an opinion that justifies that decision? That new lawyer is going to be like, yes, I can, and I'm going to do my best job of telling a story that justifies that decision, which removes an important check on the process, right? Because I think anybody who's done a lot of writing knows that the process, when you engage with it, helps you refine your thought and sometimes leads you to conclude, you know what? I thought that was the right answer. It's actually not. So I think there are lots of ways in which the system, and a lot of it is due to the fact that there are just so many more cases in the system per judge now than there used to be. Right? A lot of these things that have traditionally worked to constrain judges work less well than they used to. There are these softer pressures as well, softer constraints, things like norms and expectations of how the judicial role is supposed to be undertaken, right? And that goes back to things like ethics codes, for example, things like being dispassionate, things like really working to keep my first order ideological preferences out of the mix and thinking down the road and all that sort of thing. And as the world and the profession have become more polarized, those things as well, I think, have become less effective.
This seems to speak to this larger trend of what I believe you describe as an erosion of norms in the judiciary. I'm interested to know what the norms are that have been eroded, essentially. What are the norms that you're talking about?
I think some of the norms are, and you know, I'll point to the Wisconsin Supreme Court as a place that exhibits this, right? It has become routine in some of the recent cases for the justices to openly accuse one another of being partisan in their opinions. And, you know, one of the norms is a norm of engaging in good faith and of taking my colleagues to be engaging in good faith. It would take a little bit to unpack specifically all of what goes on underneath that and what that means exactly, but that's one of them, right? I need to understand, I think, if I'm a judge or justice on a multi-member court, that I'm doing the best I can to get this right, and so is everybody else. And if we lose that trust, then all sorts of associated norms of how we interact with one another and our willingness to try to understand one another's position, those are going to fall away. If I don't think you're acting in good faith, I'm not going to be inclined to think about what you're saying, why you might be saying it, whether it makes sense, whether I might be wrong to think otherwise. I'll just dismiss what you have to say. That's not how it's supposed to work. That's not how it works well.
So given that Wisconsin's state Supreme Court justices are elected, would you recommend that we think of justices as politicians? Is that too – it's a little more complicated.
Well, practically speaking, I mean, the answer is, you know, in terms of how the world works is one thing, and how I think the world should work is an entirely different thing. So how the world works is, yeah, we're – like that's where we're at is, you know, they're – it is nonpartisan in name only, and we all understand these races to be proxy battles in the larger political wars taking place in the state. In my ideal world, right, where we care about judicial character and good judgment, we wouldn't be focused on that at all. Right, the campaigns would be about demonstrating, here's why I exemplify the qualities that a judge ought to have, and you should select me. That's tough, right, because that doesn't sell as easily as partisan rhetoric does. So how we get to that world, I don't know, but that's the world I'd like to live in.
Chad Oldfather is a professor of law at Marquette University Law School and the author of a new book called Judges, Judging, and Judgment: Character, Wisdom, and Humility in a Polarized World. He spoke with Joy Powers and Sam Woods for WUWM's podcast, Swing State of the Union. The first episode is available now, and you can find it at WUWM.com and wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes will drop every Wednesday leading up to the April general election. You can also hear episode 1 tomorrow at noon right here on WUWM. Just like Swing State of the Union, Lake Effect is also a podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, we'll speak with a director and an actor starring in a production of the show The Children, showing now at Next Act Theater. We'll learn about the play in about 15 minutes. But first, many Wisconsinites will have visited the Wisconsin Dells. But we'll share some things you may not know you can do in that popular tourist destination. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We're in the home stretch of winter, but it's not quite time to start taking those outdoor trips yet. So for this month's Wandering Wisconsin, we'll help you plan a trip where you can find endless entertainment indoors. The Wisconsin Dells is a popular tourist destination for people who want to stay close to home. But it's not just about the water parks. There's lots of things to do you might not have tried yet or even know about. Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen is joined by Logan Rogge from Travel Wisconsin and Brandon Schindler with the Wilderness Resort to learn about some of the hidden gems in the Dells.
It's February. We all might have a little cabin fever. So this month we're focusing on a trip you can take where you can have fun indoors. And we need look no further than the Wisconsin Dells. There is more stuff to do there than we'll be able to cover today, but we're going to start with the big draw, the water parks. Brandon, there are 8 water parks at the Wilderness, 4 of which are inside. So tell us what those parks have to offer.
Well, I guess first and foremost, they have to offer 85 degree weather year round. So it's nice in the parks at all times. It's a good way to get out of the cold and the doldrums of winter and find some warm fun. The parks here, you know, have something for everybody. It's certainly a goal of ours to do that. We've got a very large wave pool in our Water Dome water park, which also has a tan through roof. So even again, in the winter time, you can find a way to soak up some sun. In that same water park, we've got a couple of large raft slides and then a toddler play area as well. In another of our parks, Klondike Cavern, our indoor lazy river can be found for lounging and just kind of floating around. That same park also has an indoor outdoor hot tub again for the lower key moments, if you want to just kind of hang out. On the flip side of that, if you're looking for some thrills, our most thrilling slide, the Hurricane, is located in that park. Besides that, we've got a couple of body slides and a couple of tube slides in there as well, and a very large multi-level play structure for the kiddos to enjoy. Moving over to the Wild West Water Park, this is more slide driven. Again, we have a large indoor play feature for the kids, but then the bulk of this park is about the slides. There are 2 large dueling mat racer slides, as well as 2 large dueling tube slides, the Black Hole, which is another thrill ride of ours, and then the Fantastic Voyage, which is a family raft ride. Not to be missed for the adults in the crowd that might be looking for an adult-only space or a beverage, we have Margarita's Swim Up Bar in the Wild Water Dome, and we have yeehaws in the Wild West Water Park. And then last but not least, Wilderness on the Lake actually just got a renovation of its indoor space completed this past fall. So there's a this is geared more towards the smaller kids, and it is a smaller park, but a new play structure in that space, and then a lily pad walk, basketball hoop area, and then indoor-outdoor hot tub there as well.
Many parents know you can't stay at the water park all day, and there's lots more to do at the resort, like escape rooms and go-karts. So talk about some of the other things you can do on a visit to the wilderness.
Yeah, we try to pitch ourselves almost as a cruise ship on land, right? Once you show up, we don't want you to ever have to leave. We want you to be entertained from sun up to sundown. So yeah, like you said, lots of dry activities to do. We've got a ropes course. We've got mega arcades, redemption arcades. We've got mini golf. We've got indoor go-karting. We have climbing walls. There's laser tag. So lots and lots of things to do outside of the water parks to keep you entertained. And then plenty of food and beverage options and retail shops and things like that.
And candy. Don't forget the candy.
Absolutely, candy. We've got two candy cabins here on property. We make a lot of that stuff right here in-house. And in fact, you can watch our candy makers do their thing throughout the day.
And one new thing the wilderness is offering is Aquavia Lumina. What's that experience like?
Well, we're both very proud of it and very excited about it. We opened this past October. It is a multimedia nighttime nature walk, which begs a lot of questions, I'm sure. But we've utilized the canyon that kind of bisects our property that we've never taken advantage of in the past. And we've created a story world of sorts around and through this canyon where you're going to basically travel with a deer guide of sorts along this path and experience these nine chapters of this story. And in each chapter, there's lights and lasers and music that kind of guide you along to the end, which is ultimately a search for the source of all things. And with the Dells being the water park capital of the world, you can imagine what that source would be. But again, a very unique experience, something we're tremendously excited about and hope that everyone comes to enjoy. It is open to the public, so you need not be a guest of ours. But yeah, if you come to the Dells, please check it out. It's worth it.
Logan, as I mentioned, it's going to be really hard to cover just how much there is to do in the Dells, but let's talk about the Sundara Inn and Spa. This place, it's won awards. It underwent this big expansion a couple years ago. It is one of the nicer spas that I've been to. So can you talk about what's offered there?
You're right, Becky. Sundara gets a lot of attention, and that's for good reason. This is really one of those unexpected parts of the Dells. It's this destination-worthy spa where visitors can go and really energize their soul. You have plenty of ways you can do that. They offer traditional spa services like massages, maybe nail services or body treatments. All of it is going to make you feel so relaxed at the end. Sundara also specializes in energy therapies. So these are treatments that use Ayurvedic massage techniques that are designed to release energy for this holistic healing. And after treatment, you can maybe warm up outdoors. They have some year-round heated pools there. I've always heard rave reviews about this place, including from some of my coworkers who've gone there for a girls' trip, personal reflection, or whatever the reason.
Yeah, and you can't beat that indoor-outdoor pool. Let's touch on some other indoor entertainment, like the Rick Wilcox Show. It kind of gives old Las Vegas. So what can people expect from the Rick Wilcox Show?
Yeah, you know, if you're looking for a little razzle and dazzle, a little Vegas-style magic for your Dells trip, look no further than the Rick Wilcox Show. This has really been one of those mainstay indoor attractions of the Dells for decades. Last year, they actually celebrated their 25th anniversary. So you might have been there before, but it's certainly worth a repeat visit. The show is actually run by husband and wife couple, Rick and Susan Wilcox, and each year they update that performance. This is to ensure those repeat visitors keep being awed and they can continue to make new memories. You know, you're going to really be amazed by some sort of like grand illusions, comedy, the special effects, all of it working together. And they have those performances year round, so it's a perfect indoor addition to get out of the winter cold or out of that summer heat.
And one other place I'd like to highlight is Wizard Quest. I think it's one of the more unique things that you can do in the Dells. So what happens on a trip there?
I love this place, Becky. So visiting Wizard Quest, it's like stepping into a whole other world. It's this fantasy-themed interactive game that challenges the guests to complete quests. So it's a intricately designed 30,000 square foot labyrinth, and it's full of these impressive decorations, custom sculptures, amusing characters, and so much more. The family that actually owns and operates Wizard Quest designed and built many of these themselves, so there's this really cool personal touch to it. But when you get there, you'll get a tablet that will guide you through the space and help you find and complete quests among four different realms. That's fire, water, earth, and air. And completing those quests, it can involve anything from finding hidden messages using a blacklight flashlight, locating several hidden passageways, and then deciphering riddles. It's fun for children. It's fun for adults. I can vouch personally. I visited a couple years ago and was totally impressed by the experience.
Couldn't agree more. Logan, what is one thing that might surprise people that you can do in the Wisconsin Dells?
You know, when I think of the Dells, I just think of one word. I think of unexpected. I had visited so much growing up, and each visit, we just discovered some new attraction, a new restaurant, a new water park, and it made those trips feel fresh. So it's not a static destination. It's dynamic, it's evolving, it's changing. And it's one of those destinations that is built by people who have big imaginations, where you can find fun indoors and outdoors, whether that is, you know, a large indoor wave pool where you can suntan at the wilderness or something unexpected like Wizard Quest. But it's also a destination that is great for all sorts of trips that you wouldn't expect. It is incredibly family friendly, and that's a massive appeal to it. But I have known several people who have hosted bachelor, bachelorette parties there. It's great for family reunions, for meetings and conventions. There's so many reasons that people choose to go there. And when they get there, they have so much they can do that it fits their needs perfectly.
And Brandon, same question for you.
Well, selfishly, I would love to say Aqua Via Lumina. It's not only unique to the Dells, it's unique to the Midwest. And in fact, there are only less than 30 of these installations worldwide. So it's something very new, very unusual, and well worth a visit. But otherwise, I would really echo a lot of what Logan said. You know, it's not necessarily one thing. It's all of the things. This is a little town with big ambitions. And there's a lot of local families here that run some major businesses in town. And there's kind of this one-upsmanship that constantly goes around. It's friendly, but competitive at the same time. So we're all always trying to introduce new things, bring new ideas, bring new attractions, both wet and dry, to the area to keep those folks that have visited us before coming back and to bring new folks in that haven't seen us yet.
All right. Well, Brandon and Logan, thank you both for being here for Wandering Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Brandon Schindler is the Assistant General Manager at the Wilderness Resort, and Logan Rogge is a Senior Communications Specialist with Travel Wisconsin. They both joined Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen for our series, Wandering Wisconsin. A new season of Bubbler Talk starts next week, and we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and when we return, we'll learn about Next Act Theater's current show, The Children.
Once the play starts, it's a little, some people have described it as a kind of like a train starts, and it just keeps chugging along.
Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A play that explores how people respond to personal and professional challenges is being staged at Next Act Theater in Milwaukee. It's called The Children. WUWM's Susan Bentz is joined by the director, Marie Kohler, and one of the three actors featured in the show, Brian Mani, to learn about it.
as the play begins, we're in the little cottage by the sea that's resided in by two nuclear scientists, retired, who have been associated with a nuclear power plant, which has had an incident. And they are kind of trying to live normal day-to-day lives. And the surprise factor is an old friend comes and who had also worked at the plant and has a rather challenging question to ask them, request of them.
So you first saw this play in California in 2020?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah,
I saw it at a theater called the Aurora Theater in Berkeley, and it just, it really made an impact. I thought it was quite stunning and provoking, thought-provoking, and it had people of my generation on stage, which is not really, I mean, in theater these days, you often see young people or really old people who are character actors. But the people who were kind of in charge for generations, scientists, whatever, are not really, you know, in their 60s or 70s, they're not really thought about much. And I thought immediately when I saw it, I thought, oh, this is us. This is me. This is my generation being represented on stage. How fascinating. And I think that's one of the unusual characteristics of the play.
So, Brian, you're one of the three characters. You're the guy on the scene.
I'm the guy, yeah.
tell me about Robin.
How to describe him? I think he's a bit of I think he's bored with life. And I think he's a very human, vulnerable person, human being with foibles. He has not acted with the highest standards in his life, but I think he's a good man.
Yeah.
But personally, he's not lived a pure life. But he's, I guess, what you would call a good guy. I think he's deeply sad until this visitor comes to visit the couple. And I think that engages him and enlivens him. And once the play starts, it's a little, some people have described it as a kind of like a train starts and it just keeps chugging along until the end and it gains momentum as it goes. I think he's a man that learns something during the play, and the audience certainly learns things about him during the play.
The title, The Children, when you first saw the play and then as you've then taken it on as director, have your thoughts around the title evolved?
They have, actually. The first line in the play is, "How are the children?" says the visiting friend. And they continue to talk about their children. And as the play goes on and you realize we're talking about a generational kind of impact that might be made, for better or for worse, at a nuclear power plant, you think, okay, it's all the generations after that come after, your children, your grandchildren, your great, blah, blah, blah. And then, actually, it was Cody Estill, who's the artistic director here, after the first run-through, said to me, "I don't think they're very grown up. I think they might be children, too." I said, yeah, I think you're right. And then I researched what the playwright had said about her play, and that was one of the things she said. They're all children in this play. And it's about trying to grow up. And hopefully, I think they maybe do during the course of the play.
Yeah.
And it's of course, it throws it open to us as the audience. Is what can we do in our lives to be more mature, to be more responsible about the things we do, the decisions we make, professionally and personally?
Lucy Kirkwood mm-hmm. is the playwright.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that her inspiration initially was a disaster.
I think she was commissioned to write a play about climate change. I may be wrong, but I thought that I read that. And then she was very inspired by reading about what happened at Fukushima when the elder scientists who were retired decided to go in and offer themselves to volunteer to help the what had happened at Fukushima with all the flooding and waters in the plant because the generators were in the basement, which was a basic human error. And she found that a very moving story. They wanted to spare the young ones
the young scientists' longevity and health, which would have been compromised had they gone in.
Marie mentioned a human error in having the generators in the basement. It's a design error. I think until Fukushima had happened, no one had even considered that a tsunami might hit and might flood the basement. But then you got to think, well, these are pretty smart people. They should have considered all of the repercussions that could happen through nature. So it is a parallel. And so I started mining the mistakes he's made and the choices he's made in his life, which makes it a very rich play and a rich play to dig into every night.
So Marie, when you think of your career thus far and the work that you've done, have the environmental challenges that we face, climate change, does that enter more into your thought process as you think about the projects that you want to take on, or do you weigh it based on all of the important elements?
I think as far as my work professionally in theater, the latter thing is more true in that I examine a play or I think of a subject that interests me. For instance, I'm working on a play about Mary Knoll, an outsider artist who lived along the lake. That naturally has some environmental themes that twine through it. But then I also wrote a play about an 18th century diarist named James Boswell, which really doesn't have any environmental connections at all. So first of all, I look at the play's material, and if it has something environmental in it, like this play, I really respond to it because environmental issues are very dear to my heart, personally, in my own life. You know, I've sometimes thought, what is the next stage of my life? And maybe I would want to devote it to that. I don't know. At this point, I'm a mix of causes professionally, but personally, I'm very into the environment.
One of the lines that I took a bunch of notes as I watched the show, just
you
little
sure did.
Lines that, well,
I
you know.
I do that too sometimes.
Yeah.
That was fun.
So one of the lines that just killed me was when Hazel said close to the end, I'm frightened, I don't know how to want less. Mm-hmm. Whoa.
I know. And the playwright says that's the key line in the play, so you get an A.
Hey.
Well done.
I know. I think although Kirkwood, the playwright, is not pointing her finger at people and shaming them, she is asking us to perhaps reexamine our values, take into account that wanting things, buying things, accumulating things leaves us as a culture with a problem of how those resources are channeled and dealt with. And to me, that's what it means. It's about too much accumulation, personal accumulation of things. But I think it could be seen in other ways too. She wants to be with her children who are now middle-aged and struggling with issues in their own lives. She wants to be there to fix them, to take care of them. And Robin, the father, is like, you have to let go at some point. You have to let them live their own life. You can't, it's not profitable to fix. So I think it's about all that stuff.
One thing I would like to just say too is the play has some very serious themes, which you can look at as, you know, good, strong medicine. But there's a lot of spoonful of sugar that goes into this. There's a lot of funny moments, lighthearted moments that happen. And then there's a moment when things sort of shift. And it's an enjoyable evening, both stimulating and fun.
You ultimately see this as a story of hope.
That's putting it maybe. It's a story of taking responsibility. And I feel hopeful at the end that all of these characters are taking responsibility in various ways. They may not do it all in the same way, but they all, I think, have awakened from their trances and know that there's work to be done and are ready to do it. So I think in that way, that is hopeful, that there's the chance to make redress about mistakes made. There's a chance to change directions, live more honestly, more responsibly. To me, that's hope. I'm not saying tying it up with a pink ribbon, but there have been messes made, literally. But I like to look at that as an awakening of responsibility.
That was Marie Kohler, the director of The Children, and Brian Mani, one of the actors starring in the play. It's showing now at the Next Act Theater through March 9th, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Martinson is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Katie Kokel, Susan Bentz, and Jimmy Gutierrez from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reedy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.